All right, we're holding on. We're holding on. I involve him at bays. 6 lines from the top. Okay, we left off yesterday like this. Our Mishnah had talked about you had the various cases where there's a question when the mumin developed on a kala. Was it before the kedushin? Was it between the kedushin and the nisurin? Was it after the nisurin? And we had the various cases when the husband has to bring a raya that the mumin existed before the kedushin, in which case the mekach tos, versus when the father has to bring a raya that they existed that they only came into existence after the kedushin, in which case nistach v'sadeh, which is tough luck. The chassan's tough luck. So we started discussing. We started talking yesterday. Shmuel had mentioned a din that relates the case where one person owns chamor, one person owns a para. They exchange them, and then it turns out the chamor is dead, and we're not sure whether that happened before or after the chalitza. If it happened after the chalitza, then it's then tough luck. The kinyan was a kinyan. If not, then the guy gets back his part. And we wanted to use our Mishnah as a proof for that din. So we were in the middle of discussing that. How exactly is it a proof? How exactly does either of the cases of our Mishnah relate to this case of Shmuel? We thought maybe first of all it's the case where the kala is still in her father's house when the mum is discovered, and the question is whether the mum existed before the kedushin or after it. The difference though is we said that then if the father brings a raya, he'll be able, then he on behalf of his daughter will be able to actually collect the ksuba. As opposed to the case of the part of a chamer, if the bala chamer brings proof that the chamer was still alive at the time, he's not taking out anything. He already has the part in his possession. He already did mashiach on it. Or we said, is it the second case where she's already married and then the mum is discovered, and the question is, did the mum exist did it exist before or after the kedushin or what? Still though, you have the difference is that the husband is told he has to bring the raya, but if he brings a raya that it existed beforehand, then that raya is meant to counteract the chazaka that we had beforehand. We said yesterday that the chazkas aguf, she had a chazaka that she was born without a mum. Now all of a sudden the mum has developed. She has a chazaka that the mum didn't exist until the latest possible date. On the other hand, the husband's proof that the mum existed beforehand cancels out that chazaka. It shows that obviously it existed at an earlier date. Versus in the case of the bala chamer, all we're doing is his proof that his animal was still alive strengthens his chazaka. So it's still not exactly the same thing. Rav Nachman Yitzchak says, actually, we are trying to use the first case where the kala is still living at home, meaning it's during the kedushin, as proof. But the difference is, you were asking that in that case, the father, when he brings his proof that the mum existed, that the mum came into existence only after the kedushin, you're telling me he's able to take the money of ksuba out of the husband's hands. How does that parallel the case of the parah and the chavar? The answer is, we're not talking about the ksuba. Well, kedushin. We're talking about the question, does the father, or does the daughter, or the father on her behalf, have the right to keep the kedushin money, which right now is in his possession. The ksuba is in the husband's possession. The kedushin money is in the girl's father's possession. Therefore, it's exactly parallel to the case of the parah and the chamer. And you should know, this discussion that we're saying over here is not according to the opinion that kedushin are not meant l'tibuin meaning for permanent ownership. Suppose you have a case. Let's take a typical case. Forget about mumin and everything. Suppose you have a chosim with mekadesh akala, and he gives her a prutta, he gives her a ring, as they do nowadays, or whatever, and then the kala dies, or somehow they never end up coming to nisuin. Does the chosin have the right to get his prutta or his ring or whatever back? That's a machloikus in Baba Basra. If we say kedushin lav l'tibuin nitnu, that they're not meant for permanent ownership, then it means that even though the chosin gave it to the kala or to her father, the ownership of it is still pending until the nisuin takes place. So if we say that, then pending, in other words,
there is no ownership.
Meaning, in other words, she's given it to the kala or to her father. He gave it to them, but it's not fully considered theirs yet. Until the nisuin actually takes place. That's one way of looking at it. Because should the erusin be broken off for whatever reason, then it'll have to be returned to the chassan. That's called kedushin lav l'tibuin. So if we say that, then for sure, that's what the Mishnah, our Mishnah could very well be talking about, that kind of situation. Does the father have the right to keep the Kedushin ring or not? And therefore, it would be exactly parallel to the case of the Parah and the Chamor. If the father is able to bring a proof that the mum existed before that the mum only came into existence after the Kedushin, he will get to keep the ring, or his daughter will get to keep the ring, which is exactly parallel to the case of the Parah and the Chamor, where once the Baal HaChamor brings proof that the Chamor was alive at the time of the exchange, then he gets to keep the Parah. So that's if we say Kedushin lav l'tibuyin nitu. El afilu l'manda omer Kedushin l'tibuyin nitu. Even if we say that Kedushin are meant for permanent ownership, meaning once he gives her the pruta, it's hers forever, without any condition, even if things are broken off. But hanimili Kedushin vaday, that's when the Kedushin was a certain Kedushin, and just afterwards she died or they divorced or whatever. Abba Kedushin toth. But here in our Mishnah, the whole point is we're talking, the husband wants to claim that it was a toast. I never would have been Makadosh her had I known that she had this mum. Therefore, e mighty raya ein, e loy loy. So therefore, yes, if the father can bring a proof that the mum only developed after the Kedushin, then yes, they get to keep the Kedushin money. If not, then not. So therefore, so Rav Nachman Yitzchok is saying, therefore, so the case of our Mishnah, as long as you understand the case of our Mishnah, that the argument as being not the argument is about the Ksuba money, but rather about the Kedushin money, then it's an exact parallel to Shmuel's din. And that's the proof that Shmuel was bringing. Rashi and Tosfos, by the way, discussed the issue. Are we talking about yesterday we discussed there were a couple of different ways of explaining the Mishnah. We had Rabbi Lazar's understanding that one half of the Mishnah goes according to Yeshua and the other half according to Gamliel. And then we had Rava's and Ravashi's explanation that the whole thing can be explained according to one Tana, either because we use the kan nimtzu of a kan hayu idea, that wherever we find the mum is where we assume that it came into existence, or according to Ravashi, that it's a difference who's the claimant. Is it the woman herself, or is it her father? So Rashi and Tosfos discussed the issue over here. This explanation that Shmuel wants to use the Mishnah as a proof for his din, which of these various explanations would that fit with? Okay, the Gemara says, Maisvi, I have a contradiction. A Mishnah says in Chulin, if you find the needle in the thickness of the Beis HaKosis, the Beis HaKosis is the second of a kosher animal's four stomachs. It has four stomachs. The second one is called the Beis HaKosis because it looks like the inside of it is made up of a surface that looks like a bunch of cups, like a bunch of depressions. The purpose of it basically is after the animal has chewed up some grass or whatever, that it eventually descends into that stomach and gets formed, that the Beis HaKosis forms it into a cud. And then the animal regurgitates it and then chews it again at Maligera until it gets broken up finally enough to be able to pass through and go to the other two stomachs. So the Beis HaKosis then there's an outer layer of it, and then there's an inner layer which is sort of bumpy. So if you find a needle in the thickness of the Beis HaKosis, and by the way, this happens nowadays also sometimes, it's one of the common trefus sometimes that they have to check for, is because sometimes an animal, you shovel in so much food into the animal's mouth, sometimes there can accidentally, or the animal itself is eating a huge amount at once, you can eat nails or all kinds of little pieces of metal can get in there. They have a name for it, the veterinarians call it hardware disease. Hardware disease. Nowadays, what they do is, in order to avoid it, they make the animal swallow a magnet, and the magnet stays in its stomach, and that way, any nails or whatever that it swallows will get stuck to the magnet rather than going into the Beis HaKosis. Yeah. Anyway, if it goes into the Beis HaKosis and they puncture it, that's the thing. So if you find it in, if the Beis HaKosis is punctured, then the animal's safe. So if you find this needle in the thickness, meaning. In the wall of the Beis HaKosis, so it's not actually going through from side to side, it's just in the thickness of it. Mitzad echad kasher, if it only punctured from one side, it's kasher, because the other layer of skin is still intact. Mishnei tzadin shefer, if it goes all the way through, it would be tzadin. Nimtzel kodat dam, if you find a spot of blood on the needle, or on the hole, be a duvashul if nishchita, then you know for a fact that, in other words, if you find a puncture all the way through the Beis HaKosis, check whether there's blood on it. If there's blood on it, you know that it happened before the animal was shechted, therefore it bled, and therefore it'll be tzareis. La'acha shechita, When you coat it down, if you don't find a spot of blood on it, then you know that the needle only punctured all the way through after the animal was shechted, and then it's not a problem of tzareifus. Nowadays, we don't necessarily do that, because we generally say we're not expert on things involving vedictus in animals, but yeah. Further, huglub piyamaka, what happens if you find that there was a wound there, you find that the needle did actually puncture all the way through, but you find that it scabbed over? Well, the general rule in Hilchos Tzareifus is almost any organ that gets punctured, even if it's scabbed over afterwards, we say that a krum sha'olam machmas naka is not considered anything. The animal is still tzareifa. So therefore, the animal is tzareif. But what does it help if you see that it's scabbed over? Biyadurish shloshi yamim kaidim shchita. Then you know that it must have swallowed this needle at least 3 days before it was shechted. And therefore, so if you bought such an animal, and then you found this machat ba'ovi betakosis, and you find a scab over the wound, you can go back to the guy you bought the animal from and say, look, it was a mechat kos. I wouldn't have bought it if I'd known it was tzareifa. And the proof that it happened while it was in your rishus is because this happened at least 3 days ago. Lo yehuglub piyamaka, what if there's no scab over it? So you find blood, so you know it happened while the animal was alive, but there's no scab, so it must have been sometime in the last 3 days. But when? Was it before you bought the animal or after it? You don't know. Therefore, I'm moitz mechaber ol amaraya. So whoever has the chazaka of the money will be the one who has the stronger claim. The other one will have to bring a proof that it happened beforehand. Now, what's the relevance? The e yohiv tabach dummy. So what does that mean? If the butcher who bought the animal and shechted it has already paid the money, then what are we saying? Because I'm moitz mechaber ol amaraya in this last case, he will be the one who has to bring proof that it happened more, that it happened before he ever bought the animal, and then he'll be able to take away the money. Why? On the contrary, shouldn't we say that the owner of the animal should be the one who has to bring the proof and be able to keep the money? If we're going according to Shmuel's din, given Shmuel's din, that we said the Baal HaChamor is the one who has to bring the proof that the Chamor was still alive in order to be able to keep the Parah, shouldn't we say the same thing over here?
The presumption
is we should assume it's true the owner of the original owner of the animal has the money in his possession now. But so what? Shmuel's saying it's, we're not really caring about possession. We're saying that the Baal HaChamor has to bring proof that the animal was alive. Otherwise, when we find it dead right now, we assume kind of kan nimtzu of kan hayu, that if we find it dead now, we can't necessarily assume it was alive at the time of the chalifin. Same thing over here. We should assume once we find the animal is tzareifa now, that it may well have been tzareifa before he even bought it.
But what about a chamar has to give a proof?
Well, that's what we said because we said that the kan nimtzu of kan hayu. Once we find the animal dead, then he has to bring a proof that it was alive up until the point when it's relevant.
We just said that the needle with blood.
No, but the same thing over here. We're saying you found blood, so you know what happened while the animal was alive.
Right.
But there's no scab, so you don't know whether it happened sometime within the last 3 days. But you don't know. I bought the animal 2 days ago. So did it happen the last day when you owned it, or in the 2 days since I bought it? The answer is b'dlo yahiv tab chadami. Fine, but you can answer that the case in that Mishnah is talking about where the butcher had not yet paid the money. So he has possession of the animal, and right now he has possession of the money. Yes, in that case, it'll be the owner of the animal that's going to be the one on the hook to bring the proof, because I'm oitzim mechaber olav araya. Question is, the Gemara says, my poska. How can you say that as a blanket statement? It's more common that when you buy an animal, that the guy doesn't give you the animal until you actually pay over the cash. So why should we assume that the Mishnah, why should we assume that Mishnah is talking about an unusual case where the guy was willing to give you the animal on credit and you'll pay him afterwards? Ella, so no. He also Rami by Yechezkel. When Rami by Yechezkel came from Bavel, from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, Omar, he said, don't pay attention to these general rules that my brother Yehuda, that's the Rav Yehuda of our Sogia, said in the name of Shmuel. Well, they were brothers. Rabbi Yehuda, the Amora is Rabbi Yehuda by Yechezkel. So this is Rami by Yechezkel. This is his brother. Yeah. Don't listen to what he's saying. He's misunderstanding Shmuel. Hachi Yama Shmuel. No, what Shmuel actually said. Kol shenolad sofek birshusai olav haraya. Whichever one, whoever's reshus the sofek took place in, is the one who has to bring the proof. And therefore, Batana Tuna Kala and our Mishnah about Kala supports that version of it. Not necessarily, therefore, that the Baal HaChamor has to bring the proof. It really depends whose reshus the suffix took place. Which there is a machloikas reshinim. Well, there is a machloikas reshinim what we mean by whose reshus. Do we mean, for example, in the case of the Chamor and the Parah, are we talking about, so they did the exchange. Right now, let's say, so originally Reuven owned the Chamor, Shimon owned the Parah, they switched them around. Right now the Chamor is in Shimon's possession because he did Mashiach on it. Is that all it means? When we say Birshusa, it doesn't mean that it's in his possession, even though it may not be on his property. That's how Rashi and most other Rishonim learn. On the other hand, the Rif and the Rambam learn that it means Birshusa means actually in his property. So it would actually have to be the Chamor. If the Chamor is on Shimon's property, then Shimon's the one who has to bring the proof. But if it's not in his property, let's say, for example, it's just out grazing in the meadow or something, even though Shimon actually owns it, it's supposed to own it at this point because Mashiach was done, or rather because Reuben did Mashiach on the part or whatever, nevertheless, though, you would still say that you still wouldn't say that it's considered in Shimon's Rishos because it's not physically in his actual Rishos. The Tana Tuna Kala, and therefore our Mishnah, but Kala supports that idea. Because what do we say in Mishnah? We said that the first case in the Mishnah was the problem, the mum was found while she's living at home, so therefore she's in her father's rishus, therefore it's the father that has to bring the raya. The second case is the mum is found after she's in her husband's rishus, after the nisuin, therefore the husband has to bring the raya.
So it's a question of
rishus, right?
There's no presumption to begin with.
Right.
No more coming to Kanush.
Well, that depends on how you learn the whole story over here. According to Tosfos, there is a factor of Kan Nimtz of a Kan Haya over here. Actually, Rashi says also that we're understanding that Shmuel, unlike before, where Rashi said that Shmuel wanted to understand the Mishnah according to Rabbi Lazar, that one part of the Mishnah goes according to Rabbi Yeshua and one goes according to Rabbi Gamliel. No, now we're accepting Rava's answer that the difference is Kan Nimtz of a Kan Haya. So yeah, effectively it's the same thing. Once we say the mum is found in the father's house, therefore the presumption is that it happened in the father's house before the kiddushin. The mum is found in the husband's house, therefore the presumption is that it happened there rather than way back when before the kiddushin. Okay, maybe, but now we have a contradiction. Again, from the same mission of Machat Shinim Tisbaivu Betakosis, the hardware disease problem again. And again, you're back to the question, the Idolo Yav Tabach Dami, if we assume that it's a case where the butcher who bought the animal did not yet pay money, then we're saying that the original owner of the animal is going to be the one who has to bring the proof that the treifa only happened after the animal was sold, and then he'll be able to take the money away, then he'll be able to collect his money. Again, here the suffix is only found in the tabach's reshus, because it's only found after the animal shechted. So why should we ever assume that the Baal HaBehema should be the one who has to bring the proof? The answer is the Yohiv Tabach Dami. Okay, here, unlike the previous answer where we wanted to say it's a case where he hadn't paid money yet, here we'll assume that the case is where he did pay the money.
The usual case.
But the question is still the Maib Sukkah. Still, how can you say it as a blanket statement? Sometimes it's done one way, sometimes it's done the other way. Why should we assume the Mishnah is talking about something that will only be true in one case? And why should Shmuel assume that the Mishnah means only that one case? The answer is some of the Milsa, because it's more usual, Kamadala Yohiv, Inish Zuzi, until Reuven gives the money, then Shimon is not going to give him the actual animal.
Why should we assume the opposite?
Well, that was the Gemara's question before, but now the Gemara had assumed that maybe it's common enough to do both ways, but it's much more common that you don't actually hand over the goods until the money is given in. Then the Mishnah had finished off a Mumin Shabbaseisa, that the Chachamim made a distinction between hidden Mumin and visible Mumin, where visible Mumin, the husband doesn't have a claim on B'chlal because he must have known about them before the Nisuin, versus hidden Mumin, where he may not have known of them, except we said if there was a back house in town and he could have his female relatives check it out. Amar Rav Nachman, V'nichpe, if the woman is epileptic, K'mumin Shabbaseisa, Dami, that's like a hidden Mum. So therefore, the husband, if he finds out after the kedushin or after the nisuin that his wife is epileptic, then he has a claim to say that the kedushin are batal or to divorce her without a ksuba, as the case may be.
That's considered a mum.
It's considered a mum. Yeah. I mean, nowadays, whether it would apply nowadays if they have medications for it, I don't know. But yeah. Bahani mili the kviyaleis man. This is only if the epilepsy, if the epileptic fits have a certain frequency, a certain schedule to them. Like it happens once every X number of weeks, let's say. Then it's considered mumen shebaseser. Then it's considered a hidden mum. Because let's say it only happens once every 3 weeks. So during these 3 weeks, she looks perfectly normal. He may not have realized. Ava like kviyalei, but if it has no fixed time. Then it's considered like an open mum. Rashi says the difference is like this. If it has a certain schedule, she knows, for example, that every third Sunday she's going to have an epileptic fit. Fine, so she makes sure to not be around him when that happens, or not to be around people b'chlal. So therefore, it's a mum shebaseser. He may not find out about it until the, you know, 3 Sundays after they get married, then all of a sudden she has an epileptic fit. If it's loik vilez man, if there's no fixed time for it, she's not able to stay locked away in the house all the time anyway. Necessarily, at some point, people will have known about it. And therefore, we should assume that the husband or fiancé will have known about it and been mochel on it.
That's the usual case.
Yeah. Mishnah says, so now the previous Mishnah talked about mumim of the wife. How about the parallel case where the husband has a mum? If the man developed a mum, we don't force him to divorce his wife. This is talking about, what is this talking about? Small mumim. But major mumim, such as we'll talk about in the Gemara, that we do force him to divorce her. Obviously only if she wants. If she wants to stay married to him, because hey, as we'll learn in the next Mishnah.
Why do we start the
Mumim Ktanim? Because Rav Shimon says that I agree with you, Tanakama, on Mumim Ktanim, but Mumim Gdolim is a different situation.
The
Tosfos says because a husband is not his wife's sada. A husband is not his wife's possession. The wife is the husband's possession, kind of. He's kinder her. Therefore, you can speak of Nistakfa Sadeo. It's his tough luck that he bought a field and now it's flooded. But you don't. It doesn't. It's not the other way around. She's not kinder him.
Not
halachically,
but practically,
it's a different question. No, okay. Thing says, now, we have the Mishnah had started off, which means that Mumin developed afterwards. So we have actually Machloikas in the Girsa. Rav Yehuda Tani Noldu, that was Rav Yehuda's version of the Mishnah, is the way we have it, that the Mumin developed afterwards. Chia Barav Tani Hoyu, whereas Chia Barav's version of it is that the Mumin existed. Chia Barav's version is that the Mumin existed, meaning that they may have even been there from before the Kiddushin. So, Manda Amen Noel Du Kol Shekin Hayu. If according to Rabbi Yehuda's version, that the Mishnah says that they developed afterwards, then Kol Shekin Hayu. How much more so if these Mumin existed before the Kiddushin, then of course, the Kasavar of a Kibla, then of course she has no claim for divorce because she must have known about them beforehand, and she obviously accepted them. Manda Amar Hayu, whereas according to Chia Barav's version, that the Mishnah is talking about where he had them before, I will know Dulai, but according to him, if the woman developed afterwards, maybe not. Maybe we would force him to divorce her if she said, I can't stand it. Thing was says, Tanan, well, let's consider. Our Mishnah says, Amar Nav Shem... We learned in the Mishnah, Amar Rav Shimon Gamli, Abamed Mumin Ktanim, that when we're talking about small mumim, Avob Mumin Golem Kofinot Elaiti. So, Bishlam Laman Daman Nol Du, so according to Rav Yehuda's version, that the mumim developed afterwards, Hainer Deshaini Ben Golem Ktanim. And we understand there's a logical reason for Rav Shimon Gamli to differentiate between small and big mumim. Small mumim, even though he didn't have the mum beforehand, the fact that it's small, we should tell her basically, live with it, as opposed to, if it's mumim gdolim, I didn't marry him expecting that he's going to have a mum gadol. Elam under Amar Hayu, but if we have the version of the Mishnah that he had these mumim from beforehand, malik gdolim, malik tanim, what's the difference, whether it's a big or a small mum? Hasavra v'kibla. Either way, we're saying that evidently she knew about it at the time of the Kiddushin, she accepted it, how come she suddenly change her mind? The answer is because you can answer kisvuri hishi chol lekabel va'achshav eni chol lekabel, because she might argue that, you know what, yes, it's a mum, it's a mum that existed before the kedushin. I thought that I could manage with it. Now I see I can't stand it. So if it's mum gadol, therefore Rav Shimon Gamliel might well say that yes, she has that claim that she can say I changed my mind. Okay, as opposed to a cotton, we would tell her, look, it's a mum cotton. Don't worry about it.
She can't manage,
then, you know. I'll tell you, you know, before
we
in the
assume that she can marry.
We assume that the average person can marry with it. The truth is actually we had in the previous perek the case of a meredith, a woman who doesn't want to have relations with her husband. We said there's various penalties that are imposed, etc. In a case where halacha says that she's not entitled, for example, the case of here, mumin tanim, then yes, if she doesn't want to. So the truth is the Rambam holds that any woman who argues most a lie, that my husband is repulsive to me and I can't have relations with him, then she's entitled to a get. Not necessarily to a ksuba, but she's entitled to a get. All the other Rishonim disagree with the Rambam on that. And in fact, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't even bring the Rambam Deya on that. According to the court, there's the cases where she's entitled to a divorce, and we'll get to later the question of the various cases according to the different opinions, whether cases when we force him to versus cases when she's entitled to a divorce. But other than those cases, if she just says, I don't want to stay married, then she'd be considered a meredith. Okay, ve'elohin mumim gdolim, what exactly are considered mumim gdolim? Agoras Habach, by the way, says that, and quotes from the Rif also, that this next line is actually may actually be part of the Mishnah, rather than the way we have it over here, where it seems to be part of the Gemara. So what are big mumim? Pirishim shen gamliok, nisme seinoi, for example, if he went blind in an eye, nikta yotoi, or his hand was chopped off, v'nishbur ragloi, or his leg was broken. Those are considered mumim gdolim. Okay, who's the halacha like? Itmar, Rab Abba by Yaakov, Amr Rab Yechon, halacha k'Rab Shimon Gamliel, Rav Amr Rab Nachman, halacha k'Rav Chachamim. And then in turn, within that, it's a machlokes of the poskim, which of these manda amos the halacha is like? Is the halacha like Rab Nachman? Is the halacha like Rab Yechon, in which case the halacha is like Rab Shimon Gamliel, or like Rav, in which case the halacha is like Chachamim? One thing is, the Chachamim say that it doesn't matter, mumim gdolim or mumim katanim. Either way, if it's noldu, if they develop afterwards, she doesn't have grounds for divorce. One thing it does say in Shulchan Aruch, though, is he was talking about, for example, if he went blind in one eye, or if he went blind in both eyes, or he lost both his hands, or he lost both his legs, yes, even according to the Chachamim, she'd have grounds for divorce. So it doesn't. No, the woman Gerlim, and it's like Gerlim, where like he's not even functioning, there's a certain aspect of him that's not even functioning anymore, as opposed to he became blind in one eye. Okay, he still has one good eye. The question is, did Rav Yechonon really say that? The halacha is Rav Yechonon in our Mishnah. Any place where we have an opinion of Rav Yechonon in Mishnah, as opposed to Raifas, halacha can be said, and halacha is always like him, except for three. Orev, Sidon, Uriah, Achrona. These are three cases. Orev is a case at the end of Baba Basra, where you have a loiva and you have an Orev, and the question is, can you collect from the Orev, or do you have to first go to the loiva if he has money? So there's machlokes of Shimon Gamliel and Chachamim there. Sidon is a case in Gittin involving a get that was given out tonight, that she brings him his cloak and itzelis. It's lost or burnt or whatever, and there's machlokes over there. The Chacham say in that case, the get is not chal. Rav Shimon Gamliel says she can just pay him the value of it, and the get is chal. And it's like the English word for it is stole, cloak. That's Sidon and Raya Achrona is a case in Sanhedrin. Machlokes over there if Beis Din judged a case, and after the case was decided, then after the case was decided, all of a sudden the person says, you know what, I found Edom, or I found new proofs, or whatever. So the Chacham say, never mind, the case has been decided already. Reb Shimon Gamliel says, what the poor guy was supposed to do, he didn't have his Edom beforehand, therefore you should believe him. In those three cases, then the halacha is not like Reb Shimon Gamliel, Reb Yechon is saying. In all other cases, it is. So why does Reb Yechon have to say over here that halacha is like Reb Shimon Gamliel? The answer is Amaroyim in what Rav Yechon, and there's actually different Amaroyim, what different versions in what Rav Yechon said. One version is what Rav Abba Chana said, that in all except for those three cases, the halacha is from Shimon Gamliel. The other version is that no, there's more cases than that, and therefore Rav Yechon would have to specify in each case. According to one way of looking at it, there's more than three places where the halacha is not like Rav Shimon Gamliel, and therefore we have to specify that this is not one of them.
They're both cases in the same category?
No, not necessarily the same categories. I mean, each of those is a different case in halacha. Two of them are dinimonis, one is hilchos gittin. Okay, Mishnah says, ve'elu shekofet b'tzalayim. The following cases, though, is to force the husband to divorce his wife. Mukashchin, Mukash Shin, the basic meaning of it is something that's Shin, like boil. We'll talk about the Gemara, actually, it may not be so simple necessarily. It's obviously some kind of skin disease, but what it is exactly we'll get to. Ubal Pulipus, somebody who has Pulipus, which also we'll talk about in the Gemara what that is. It is related to Republics, yes, but wait. Bamakamet and Makamet, which again the Gemara is going to explain. Bamatsara Pukosh, a person who smelt refined copper. Bahabursi and a tanner. The point of it is basically that all of these are disgusting in one way or another. Either the Mukushkin and Bal Pulipus are physical conditions that make them repulsive, and the other three smell because of the work they do. That's machlokes, actually. When we say it here, when we talk about it here, that we force him to get divorced, do we say, obviously, again, if she wants to stay married today, we're going to say that they can stay married another day, if she can make something else. But do we force him to pay the ketor or not? So the intention is that no, because he can argue, look, I wouldn't have wanted to divorce her. If I'm at fault, for example, capable of going on the Gemara, we said that I want to support you, and I have to force him to divorce. Okay, well, it's my fault. I'm the one doing something bad. Therefore, fine, I can accept that I should have to pay the sugar. Not my fault that I'm a mukushkin, wherever I should have to pay the sugar. That's Rabbeinu Gershom argues. On the other hand, most other Chayim say that no. As a matter of fact, he does have to pay the sugar. Tosafot mentions it over here. One other argument Rabbeinu Gershom brings is because otherwise, if you can say you have to pay the ksuba, what's going to happen? Every poor mukushkin, some woman is going to go and marry him, and then claim, you know what, I can't stand living with him, let's get divorced, and then and all of a sudden, I've got to hear some of money out of it. The Tosafot answer is, the reasonable answer is very simple. If the base realizes that we're talking a case of trickery over here, then yes, she's not entitled to the ksuba. Other than that, though, she should be entitled to it.
What people first read, you know, that marriage, you want
1 second. Whether any of these things, the Mokshin, Bursi, or what have you, existed before he was married, or whether it came into existence only after he got married. Either way, we're saying if she says, I can't stand it, then we can force him to divorce her. I'll call an Amar Meir about all these cases. The Meir says, even if he specifically made a snipe with her for these things. So he says, you know, I'm a tanner. Nevertheless, if you like to marry me, you're going to have to live with yourself. And she says, okay. You should tell me. Later on, Rameer says, she can say, I thought I would be able to stand it, but after any Yechol Kabul, now I see I can't stand it. She will have to accept it, even Bal Kocha. She'll have to live with it. Except for the case of Mukushkin, because she causes him to fall apart. Mukushkin, as we'll talk about, is a wasting disease of some kind. It makes his body fall apart. It makes his limbs like atrophy and then fall off. Kashmish is very bad for the person. So therefore, don't allow her to stay married to him because they're gonna have relations, and that's just gonna make things worse. It's gonna aggravate his condition.
He wants to get married to her.
Nevertheless, wait, we'll see on the days there is a way that they can get around it. As it happened in Sidon, the tanner who died, but they're like off Bursi, and he had a brother who was also a tanner, and it was a case they died childless, and we helped the Syrian the woman has a valid claim. She can say, when it came to your brother, I can manage it. For example, he had good midrash, let's say, so therefore I was willing to overlook the smell. Okay. But you, I can't stand it. So therefore, she has a valid claim, and therefore would make the brother do chalitza rather than yibum. No, it's not my chalitza, because we said that she has to accept it from her husband himself, not from a yavam. It means that the bad smell coming from his nose. You mentioned that Pulipus is like the root of polyps. So Steinsalt points out that it could very well be, we're talking about some kind of, he has like a chronic sinus infection or whatnot. These days you take antibiotics for it. In those days, it could very well, after a while, develop from the bacteria, develop bad smell. In the bright it says it doesn't mean a bad smell from the nose, it means bad smell. And actually, the halacha is both those. The halacha is really that those either one is a valid enough reason for Beis Din to force them to give her a get. We're just arguing what the actual word pull it means. That's what we're saying. This is considered as an example of Gerbla. Yeah. Rav Asi learns the other way around, that Rav Shmuel is the one who said it's a bad breath in the mouth, and the Rai said it's in the nose. Umana, and he gave the following symptoms to remember it. Shmuel, like Pasuk Kume, Shmuel's mouth did not stop from learning this whole parrot. So therefore, that helps us remember the association between Shmuel and the mouth. What specifically what do you mean? I mean, Shmuel learned the whole shas. We first talk about that almost every Mishnah of this Perek, Shmuel specifically had something to say about it. That's what we mean, this Perek, more than any other, we find that Shmuel has something to say on the entire Perek. Okay. Then we said Amakamet, my Amakamet. I'm going to be holding the Amakamet, Soyas Club. I mean, somebody who collects dog poop. Now, what's the purpose of it? So Rashi says, I don't know, what would you use that for? And he says, and when what? So, one second. So, Rashi says, so, apparently it's not very good fertilizer, I don't know. Or Mustama, you can probably just use other kinds of excrement for the same purpose and probably get a lot more. So, Rashi says, when I was in Germany, he says, for Ashkenaz Raisi, that what they do is when before they do laundry, they take the clothes and they soak them in that for a day or two. The idea is the acid in them or something helps break down stains, I don't know. Proshim points out that actually there are a number of places where the Gemara says it's also at the end of Perek Shira and a few other places they used to use it for canning leather. So why doesn't Rashi just say that over here? And the answer is because the Gemara is going to be talking about this, there seems to be a contradiction. We mentioned Bursi, why mentioning the Pampas is a separate thing. Evidently Rashi said we can't mean over here they're collecting it for purposes of canning, it has to be something else. Anyway, okay. Mace, Gemara says, I have a contradiction. Rice says, Mekamet is a mercy, and Mekamet is a tanner. So then he's not somebody who collects dog poop. It's somebody who tans skins. Possibly, Tamech, new according to your own Sora. Kishlof Masnit, new we have a contradiction from all Mishnah itself. A Mekamet, a Messiah, a Choshes, a mercy. So Mekamet and a mercy are listed separately. So obviously, that contradicts the Brisa. Well, that's not a big deal. This shouldn't have this in my capture. Okay, I understand there's not a skitter from Mishnah. Kind of mercy God or kind of mercy cousin. Because there could be a difference between a big bursi, one who does a lot of tanning, who has a big tannery, versus a small one. He's poor, he only has a few skins to do. So you could say that there's that distinction. Bursi in our Mishnah would mean a bursi gadol, and in a comment maybe would mean a bursi cotton. El or Rabbi Yehuda Kasha, according to the question is according to Rabbi Yehuda. If according to Rabbi Yehuda, a comment is not nothing to do with tanning, but rather a comment says clothing to use for laundry, and how does that isn't that a contradiction to the Braitha that says that Mekamet is a Bursi? The answer is Tanrahi. It's actually Makhlokas Tanrahi. The Tanya, Mekamet is a Bursi. We have to understand Mekamet Tayas Klavim. So, sort of when we put the Mekamet Tayas Klavim, he's going according to one opinion. Our missionary is going according to a different opinion. Okay. Then we said Mamatara from the Khoshis Bursi. We said a person who refines copper. And a Bursi, my Mekhara Nefashis, Rav Ashiya Makachli Dudi, somebody whose job is to hammer out sheets of copper to make pots and things like that. So first of all, the copper itself, Rashi says Masriya, smells. And copper a lot of times, there's sulfur in it and various other elements that smell bad. Number two, other Mefarshim point out that also person works all the time feeding out copper and refining it or whatever, he's always filthy, he's always black all over. And then the wife will have a valid time that I'm repulsed by that. Rabba Baba Chono of a Zamachatach and the Choshes Neikrai. It means a person who mines copper. Same idea, copper ores, again, Steinbaum points out, the copper ore a lot of times has various sulfides mixed in with it, while mines tend to smell anyway, because it's 100 pounds and not much air gets into them. So again, the guy constantly smells. We learned, by the way, in Chagiga, that even these kinds of people, the Mekamets and the Messiah from Koshet, even though they're smelly and disgusting, they still have Chiva of the Regal. We said that either the Rambam says they have to clean themselves up and be oil of the regal, or I think other Mepharshim say it just means, okay, even if they can't clean themselves up completely, nevertheless, you don't say they're part of the regal to spare other people's noses. No, they're still part of the Jewish people, and they get to go to the Mishnah with everybody else. That's a different question, actually. I mean, that gets into the question of whether we know you're not allowed to daven in the presence of the smell of soy or whatever, does that apply to the bad smell as well? Okay.
They can't take a bath and just get
them in the skin. Maybe they could, but it might be kind of like baked into their skin. You know, you work with something day after day for years, you know, after and after. Okay.
Yeah, it's all going to fill the long way, year out.
Yeah. Okay. Since we mentioned in the Mishnah that there's certain cases where we force husband to divorce his wife, these various cases, so now we have another one. If a husband says to his wife, I'm not going to support you, I'm not going to feed you, and I'm not going to support you, then you make him divorce her and pay her chsuba. So that's another case where we force them to divorce.
He actually has to say, or if he doesn't do it.
Might be either one, I don't know.
If he doesn't do it.
If he doesn't do it. Okay, but as a practical matter, yeah, it would be the same thing. Yeah.
So what do we say?
Okay, well, Omer, because he's saying he hasn't actually started it yet, maybe this is the fact that he didn't have to be enough. Other went and told over this teaching to Shmuel. Omar and Shmuel didn't like it. He said, I swear, sorry, Elazar. Elazar deserves to eat barley, which is animal food. Meaning, what you said, what you told over here makes no sense. Like repeating it over without any symbol of animal. I mean, other Mepharshim say a whole different thing. They mean Elazar at some point must have eaten barley. Otherwise, he'd always eaten animal food. He would realize that it makes no sense. Anyway, talking about basically forcing him to do the right thing, why should they have to force him to divorce her? Force him to support her. The Rav, and what would Rav answer back to that? He would say, you can't expect a person to live with a snake in a basket because it's the end of the day. A snake is unpredictable, can bite at any time. The same thing, once the guy said, or actually did, any zombie him a friend, well, even something based in it and forced him to actually be zombie a friend, fine, but the snake can wake up again and just have to do it all over again. You can't expect her to deal with that kind of situation. So therefore, Rav is saying, forget about forcing him to be zombie, just force him to divorce her and then get her out of the situation. You point out that actually even Shmuel would agree that there are cases where you can't force him to be gone, so then his tax has no money. In that case, then yes, Shmuel would agree. In that case, he forced him to divorce. Okay, but that's the point. You shouldn't think that Shmuel is saying across the board. Even he would agree sometimes. Yes. He saw it from Zero, when Zero ran out from Babel, and we moved from Babel to Israel. After the Rabbi Yaman by Yefes, he found Rabbi Yaman by Yefes, Yosef Kamalam Shmei Rabbi Yechanan, that Rabbi Yaman by Yefes was saying over the same thing that Rabbi Lazar had recorded in the name of Rav, that you forced him to divorce him and give her a chuba. Rabbi Yaman by Yefes was saying the same thing over in the name of Rabbi Yechanan. Amalei Rabbi Yaman told him, you should know that it's not a right thing. I'm a boss, sort of firing my laws of Babel. It's because of this kind. Rabbi Lazar said over this thing in Babel and then made him eat barley for it. So in other words, it's not a correct teaching. Post can actually argue whether in fact the halacha is like Rav and Rabbi Yechanan or like Shmuel in this regard. Again, there are certain cases where everybody would agree that you force them to divorce, but in the cases when not, it's a machlokes the post in which one we follow. Do we force them to divorce her, or do we just force them to feed her, and I guess we would have to put somebody in charge over there to make sure that he doesn't renege on that. We only force a husband to divorce his wife if his wife is puzzled to him. TM Ritter, they're not allowed to be married. TM Ritter came to Shmuel, and Rabbi Yehuda says, when I told over this teaching to Shmuel, Omar, he said, what kind of psalm are we talking about? Could find the ones that are also Midrash Baisa or Midrash Banan. Alman of a Kohen Gadol, Grush of a Chalutz of a Kohen Hedit, Zerus in the Sinli Yisrael, Bach Yisrael, and Nadol Amanzer. But what about another case where a man married a woman and they were married for 10 years and they didn't have any children? In Kofenose, then Shmuel says in that case we do not force them to get divorced. Even though they're not supposed to be staying married because, period, Olivia. Nevertheless, since we're saying in Hassan, although it's full, it means only if she's actually puzzled to him in this case. So she's not puzzled to him, they're not having children.
He could divorce and say, I want to get
married. Well, he could divorce, that's true. But we're saying if he wants to stay married to her, now, in principle, he could marry another wife, because this is before Pecher and Deben Gershon. As a practical matter, though, he's not likely to, and even if he wants to, not necessarily is anybody else going to want to marry the daughter or any woman want to marry him when he already has a wife. So, and then he's going to be playing second fiddle over there, plus you'll have a tzara and everything. People may not want to do that.
He's obligated to
be married, but that's not, she's not in and of itself puzzled to him. If But that doesn't make her pawful to him, we're saying. Wait. She doesn't have the mitzvah period. Yeah, that's true. But that's not considered a psul. A psul is because she's lakhila also to marry him. For example, an amon on a phone level, etc.
The takana of Rabbi applies in this case where you cannot have children. We still don't force him to divorce when you take a second wife.
To the best of my knowledge, no. But actually, let's talk about in a second. The fact you don't see anybody do following this nowadays. We all know a couple who were married much more than 10 years and their children, we never heard of them divorcing. So let's put a couple of more lines and we'll talk about that angle on it. Okay. But a different version is that Rav Tachlifa Ba'avimi said in the name of Shmuel, yes, afilu nasa ishi avashah ima yurchan avala yalda, yes. Also, in a case where a man and a woman were married and she didn't have children for 10 years, also Klaver Nosei, say, then we would also force him to divorce. Because even though that she wasn't possible to him to begin with, they're not intrinsically possible. If they were to have a child, then they'd stay happily married. But our Mishnah said, Eilus Klaver lights in Mukta Shkin Vav Polipus. Our Mishnah mentioned the various cases where he's repulsive to her. So, Bishnah Lord of Asi. So, according to Asi's version, that you have only the cases where she's possible to marry him, and we're saying the Mishnah left those out, fine. So that Bonan Katani, the Raita Le Katani, because the Mishnah is only mentioning one where she's entitled to a get with Rabbanon, and not the ones where anyway the Raita have to get divorced. All the cases, I'm one of the claims, of a whole of the claim, etc., are all ones that wish after Daraisa. So fine, according to Rabbi, the Mishnah doesn't have to bother mentioning the ones Daraisa. There's no question, just like Beis Din have to prevent you from doing any Isser, so they would have to prevent you over here. The Chiddush of the Mishnah is even the cases that the Rabbanan say that she's entitled. According to the Tachlifa Ba'avimi's version, why doesn't the Mishnah also mention that case of 10 years? There also, midaraisa, there shouldn't be an issue because you could marry another woman. It's only midrabanan, that's what we just said, Rashi says over here, because as long as he's married to one woman, practically speaking, he's not going to get married to another one. So it's only midrabanan that we're telling them they have to get divorced. According to the Tachlifa Ba'avimi, why does the Mishnah mention that as well? The difference is, Rav Nachman says that in the cases of our Mishnah, if she demands a divorce and he doesn't want to give it, we would even force him to shoot him with whips. Basin would bring him in and then give him pech to force him to divorce her. As opposed to the case of the 10 years, we're saying we wouldn't force him with whips. We would ask him. We would tell him, you know, you're obligated to do period of you, therefore you should divorce her, and you'll have a chance to have children, and hopefully she will also. That's the difference, therefore, according to that understanding. That's why the mission doesn't list the 10 years, because it's a different kind of compulsion. Maski for Rabbi Abba says, what are you talking about? The Pasuk says, we brought him like you bought him Eved. An Eved does not get chastised, it's just words. Talk is cheap, in other words. You can even talk this guy in until you're blue in the face, fine as hell. Sometimes you need the actual patch. So why should it be a difference? Yes, in the case of the 10 years, if he's not willing to divorce her, yes, go ahead and bring out the cheating. No, in both cases, it's true you would force the matter with wit. The difference is, in the case of our Mishnah, if she says, you know what, I don't care the smell or the shin or whatever, I want to stay married to him, then fine, we'll let her be. You want to stay married to him, then pay. Whereas in the case of the 10 years, even if she says, I want to stay married to him, we don't allow it. Because again, you still have the issue that he's not going to, as a practical matter, he's not going to have a second wife, and therefore he's going to be prevented from period of. Now, as a practical matter, so what is the action? So we see from our Gemara over here that a couple is supposed to divorce, and the husband is even supposed to be forced if they're childless after 10 years. Well, Maya said we don't see that happening. Why not? So there's a few different things that the poets can talk about. One is that maybe all this only applies in Eretz Yisrael. We find, for example, where B'chal do we learn the 10 years from? Abraham and Sarah, after they were 10 years in Eretz Yisrael, and they didn't have a child yet, Sarah said, Hinei Amosi Hagar, go marry Hagar, and you'll have a child that way. And in the particular case, Esa Shanim, that's 10 years. That's what we learn the whole of the 10 years. Now, the point is they were married many years before that. We don't know what age they were married. There's different opinions, but whatever it is, they were married long before they ever came to Eretz Yisrael. But we see the 10 years only count in Eretz Yisrael. Because not any difference in the midst of a period, but the difference is if couples living outside Eretz Yisrael, you can say, you know why they're not having children? Because they need this course of Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, if they're living in Chutz Laaretz, then that doesn't, maybe doesn't count towards the 10 years. Other parties can say, not necessarily. Avraham is different. Avraham is cold. The average person doesn't have such a statement from the Eved. Never. Okay, but the point is that they afford if they're... That's fine. We're not saying that a couple doesn't have to have children in Chutz Laaretz. We're saying if they're in Chutz Laaretz, it may be the reason they're not having children is because they're in Chutz Laaretz. Since they may not be in a position to move to Eretz Israel, you can't force them to divorce. There's various other considerations that parties can bring up as well, even if you're living in Eretz Israel. One of them, the Rivash, points out that that basically he says that the Chachamim were to interfere in this kind of thing. Nowadays, it's much more common. There's arguments to have it. He says there's a lot of times a lack of shalom bias between couples. If the Dayanim are going to interfere in cases like this and force them to get divorced, then it's going to make even worse problems and people are going to have even less respect for the Rabbanim. So because of that, and various other considerations, we say that the size of which we also don't know, it's hard to say nowadays that necessarily because whose fault it is, kind of. So because of all those considerations, as a practical matter, that halacha does not apply nowadays. So there's the difference, then. The point is that, again, the point is, even if we say that you force them to divorce after 10 years, it's a different kind of situation than the ones in the Mishnah. Because the ones in the Mishnah, she has the option of staying married if she wants to. The 10 years, she doesn't have the option. So that's why, the Mukashchin of the Mishnah, even if she says, I want to stay married here, we don't allow her. And we said in the Mishnah, because the Mukashchin, she's going to cause it to fall apart. The Mishnah lifts the Mukashchin together with the other four cases. The answer is there's still a difference. Hossam, in the case of the Mukashchin, if she says, you know what, let's stay living together, but we'll have witnesses living in the house so that they'll make sure that we don't have that we're never alone to be able to have relations. Then we say, good, if she wants to stay married to him, go ahead. Hacha, in the case of the 10 years, even if she says, we'll live together with witnesses, we still don't allow it because it still defeats the purpose. He's still not going to get married as long as he has one wife. So there's still a difference then between that and the other cases, and therefore the Mishnah list. And we're learning from it. So speaking of this matter of Mukashkin, Amr Rav Yosi, Sochli Zokin Echad Manch Yerushalayim, an old man from Yerushalayim told me, Eftim Rabo Mukashkin, there's 24 kinds of Mukashkin. So Mukashkin is basically various kinds of skin diseases. It's not necessarily one. It's not in modern terms, it wouldn't necessarily be one disease. The different possibilities that I've seen, it can include what they call nowadays leprosy, which is a bacterial disease. It can include saras from the Torah from this week's parasha. It can include boils. It can include a number. I've been seeing a possibility that it could include really, really bad eczema. All of them, the Chachamim said Tashmish is bad for them. People who have Rasan is the worst of all. What's Rasan? The Rashi said, based on the Gemara that we're going to have soon, is a disease that a person gets. They have an infect in their brain. And we're going to talk about soon what you do, how you can do an operation to get it out.
No, but you don't bang it.
That insect was inside Titus's brain. This one is on the surface. But we'll get to it soon. From description over here, since we're mentioning Rasan among Mukashchin, it seems that it also causes sores or inflammations or whatever on the body. The Medrash, by the way, mentions that the Yerushalmi brings over here also at the end of this parak that when Pare kidnapped Sarah and the pasuk is by Naga Hashem is Pare Negoyim, what's a Negoyim Jolim? Rasan, the worst kind of Mukashchin. That's what we're saying, Tashim Mikolam. That's what it's called, the Goyim Gdolim. And before I explain, that was the point. Since we're saying that Tashmish is worse for Rasa, for Baal Rasa than for anybody else, therefore, Dafka, he was struck with Rasa in order that he doesn't lay his hands on Sarah. How is a person susceptible to Rasan? The Tanya, as we learn in the Braise, Hik is Dam B'Shemesh. If the husband lets blood and then right after that has relations with his wife, Hakim let Bonin B'Sikin. Then the children will be very weak. Hik is Ushneim B'Shemesh. If both of them let blood and then they had relations, remember, letting blood, it's like nowadays giving blood, you feel very weak afterwards. Having let Bonin Bali Rasan. And that brings to having children who are susceptible to Rasan. This is only if you didn't taste something after the bloodletting. I'll tell you maybe less than blood, but if you tasted something, then there's no problem with it. This is why nowadays, whenever they have the blood donations, they're always orange juice and the donuts and whatever, yeah. My simanim, what are the simanim? How do you recognize a person who has rasan? Dolphin ene, his eyes are always tearing. The daibi nechire, and his nose is running. The isolate rear me pume, and saliva drips out of his mouth. And flies are always following him. Yeah. Well, my asvase, how do you cure this rasan? Amar Abaya, you take as follows. Pila veludna, these are two different types of herbs. Giudio de goza, the shells, the nut shells, the Rashi says it means the bark of a walnut tree. The Oroch says it means actual nutshells. The Giudio de ashpa, and the what you scrape off from leather, like when shoemakers or whatever are scraping leather to prepare it for shoes, the pieces that come off that. On the side over here it says the ashkafa, which actually means the Oroch Giv says the ashkafa, which means leather worker. Apparently, even if we have the Giv said the ashpa, it means the same thing. The scrapings that you get off leather. When you scrape leather to prepare it for shoes or whatever, what you scrape off of it. Well, Kril Malka is yet another kind of herb, a lily or something like that. Well, Machala de Dikla Sumka. And the casing around a young unripe date, when dates first start growing, Rashi described, you have like a peel around them that falls off afterwards. We're talking about that peel. The shalakluvad dadadi, you take all these ingredients and you cook them together to make a potion. Then you bring the patient, the person with rasan, into a house made out of marble, which is waterproof. Not waterproof, sorry. It's airtight. No outside air can come in to infect him. The Eloi is the base of the Shisha. If you don't have a marble room, Ayala the base of the Shev Lidni Baricha, then instead bring him into a room where the walls are made out of seven whole bricks and half bricks. A standard brick in those days is three tefachim. So you're talking about the walls of 22 and a half tefachim thick, almost four amas thick, about six or seven feet. So again, three thick, so that's airtight. It's seven bricks, it's 21 tefachim and a half bricks, it's half a mat. Then, not to let Tlasmeh pass the oration, we'll stop in a minute. You take 300 cups, not necessarily 300, is sometimes meant as a guzma, meaning a very large amount, of this liquid that you boiled up over here out of all these ingredients, and pour it over his head. Adagafiar is the demoche, until his skull softens. The karal demoche, at that point, you can cut open the skull and to see the membranes over his brain. Now you take four leaves of hadassim. What's rasan? Rashi said before, the bug in the brain. So you lift up one leg of the bug at a time and slip in a hadass leaf underneath it. The point of that is, Rashi said, because you're going to be lifting, you're going to be trying to lift out this bug. If you don't put the hadass leaves under it, what's going to happen is it's going to dig its claws into the brain and puncture the membranes over it, whatever, and puncture them, and then the person will be upset. So you won't survive anyway. You want to survive the operation, that's why you put in the padding underneath each of the legs. So then when you lift it off, it'll lift off clean. The shot of the salsa, you pick up the bug using a pair of tweezers, the colley, and you burn it. Why do you have to burn it? If you lie, how do you live it? Because if you don't burn it, then it's going to return and then reinfect the guy again. So we'll continue tomorrow learning more. We'll continue tomorrow learning more about this and lady. One thing to mention real quick, there's a verse that I saw from the Yerlish, the deeper meaning of what we're talking about, rasa and a bug in the brain over here, we're talking about apicursis. When a person gets apicursis into their brain, it's a very delicate operation to get it out.